Okay, this is a continuation of the interview on July 16th, side two. And we were talking about your working in Santa Monica, the newspaper there, in January 1954. And you were going to talk a little bit about the technology of newspaper work in the mid-50s and what was involved in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that, in retrospect, it seems fascinating is the fact that the newspaper was just basically, then in the 50s, was basically using the same production methods that had gone on for really since the turn of the century. You know, the linotype, the use of the linotype, this cassette type, use of the typewriter to write a story, the use of the linotype to set the type and the stereotype and so on. And so the big changes were still to come, and a few things were starting to happen. Well, one thing, of course, the teletype had been around a long time. The teletype was the telegraph, you know, that came over the telephone lines, and it brought in the AP, it was essentially used for the wire service stories, and for both the Associated Press and UPI were the main ones. And but these were, you know, these were not high speed. They came at a pretty slow rate, not much faster than a typing rate, you know, mm-hmm. that would come in the offices and then come into the newspaper offices, and you'd tear off the sheets and you'd cut off the stories, and you'd edit the stories on the teletype system. And one thing that did come in that was just sort of coming in during the 50s when I was working was what was called the TTS, or the teletype setter. Mm-hmm. So this meant that when a story came in from AP, at the same time that the story was being printed out on the machine, it was also being, by another machine, it was being, a punch tape was being made. A punch tape was being made of that story. Mm-hmm. And so that when the person who was tending the machine would cut off the story, but it would also, this is kind of a lot of effort involved here. The person would also roll up that tape. The along with the printed story would be this long tape, punched tape that was for all the letters. And so you'd roll up this tape. Then that tape could be set into a device on the linotype machine, so that the linotype machine would print the story, would set the type. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it meant it saved a lot of labor on the linotype machine. Those are the printers, and the printers were well paid and so forth. And mm-hmm. it was a big part of the expense of newspaper production. But it was a big job to try to keep track of all those, because you have to decide if you're going to use that story, then you got to find the tape that goes with it.
Yeah.
So that it could be set mechanically rather than by hand, as was the case in the past. And so that was one example of something, but it wasn't a great breakthrough. But it was a little bit of labor saving and cost saving.
And this was a technology that a relatively small paper like Santa Monica
had
by 54,
right.
55.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And also the, I guess it wasn't there, but it was later on the other papers that the telephoto started coming. The telephoto started to be a system. You know, before, for a long time, you know, if you took news photos from, say, you were in Madison, Wisconsin, and there was a news photo. Something was news photo in New York. It had to be sent by mail. It would be sent by mail or some kind of courier, or whatever. But then they developed a method in those years, I guess in the mid 50s, of sending photos by. I guess it must have been kind of a form of facsimile.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That and those were starting to come in and were pretty good. So that you could send, but it was still a fairly slow process and you couldn't do it as nearly as quickly as they do nowadays.
And the pictures that you would take on your reporting, that was, I suppose, not an easy process to get that developed into newspaper pictures.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that was a big, you know, there was a lot of manpower involved. You had to had photographers. would take the pictures, and then the local news coverage, and then of course they'd have to be developed and go to the picture desk and be edited. But also there's a great deal of touching up went on. They had so-called artists who would touch up a picture to, you know, mm-hmm. to make the contrast in the background and so forth to mm-hmm. improve the photo reproduction in the paper. Mm-hmm. So it was a big. A big process. There's a lot of people involved in the production of
Now you were at Santa Monica on that paper for how long?
Oh, only about 6 months or so, because that's when we went to Europe.
Europe for was it for a year or?
Well, it wasn't a year. It was about 8-9 months, I guess. About 9 months.
And where did you go? In that
well, we were young and carefree, and our families said we shouldn't do it and so forth, you know, but we did anyway because we wanted to have the opportunity. We didn't have any children yet or anything, mm-hmm. and didn't feel like settling down. So we bought a Volkswagen in Paris. We flew to Paris, bought a Volkswagen there. We'd made arrangements. They had to pick it up. A Volkswagen Bug, one of the bugs were a big thing, and so we picked it up in this was 1954. Mostly in 54 and early into 55, and so we then proceeded to travel around through Europe. But we had the idea of doing a travel. We were going to write a book. I guess we were trying to justify ourselves, and we had the idea of sort of going around the coastline of Europe, and going stopping at sort of representative seaside areas, and doing research on those places. For instance, we stopped at a place in Holland, at a place at a sort of a representative place in Normandy in France, Brittany, and the Basque coast of northern Spain, northern Spain and southern France, because the Basque country is partly in France and partly mm-hmm. in Spain, mm-hmm. and also down along the Malaga coast. And on the Mediterranean in Spain, and a little town called Sanare in the coast of France, on the Mediterranean coast of France, and a couple of places in Italy. And we would go to these places, and it turned out, and then we would go to the local tourist office and say we're researching a travel book on this area, on France, mm-hmm. on Europe, and we're particularly want to do something about this. This community, it turned out to be a very good way to travel, because these local people would be very cooperative on giving you access to things and giving you all kinds of information, and also
did the book ever come into?
Well, no, that was the trouble.
Didn't come out.
But we really did very conscientiously collected a great deal of material. We still got the box of material at home, and we were going to write it when we came back. But when we came back. First of all, Harvard got pregnant, but she was also teaching, and I had to go to work, and in our
she's teaching just, still at UCLA.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she'd taken a leave of absence from.
Just curiosity, you'd been to Europe 4 years earlier. Were there any differences that you noticed in the 4 year period between 1954?
Yeah, it was. Europe was coming out of it a good. You could see the differences. It was still very cheap. You know, very cheap to travel. Mm-hmm. And very cheap for Americans. The dollar was very strong, and that was one of the things that we know. But Europe was really starting to come. Germany had already really started to take off, and France was lagging. But the French development came later. Spain was Spain was still under Franco, and was still pretty closed. In fact, Spain was the cheapest place of all to live. We were the two of us. You know, were living traveling in Spain. We were living on for periods of time. We were living on $5 a day, which covered the restaurants and place we'd stay at night and mm-hmm. drink before dinner or Herald Tribune or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. it was just fabulously cheap. It mm-hmm. still and Europe generally was really starting to. And the effects of the Marshall Plan and all were really beginning mm-hmm. to develop. But it was a fascinating thing, and I mean it was fascinating to be there. And we did some freelance writing too, because of Harvard's connections at the LA Times, we wrote maybe a half a dozen freelance stories that they printed on the op-ed page or whatever. And, but it was, you know, it was one of those things we did, and we didn't. Afterwards, we decided it didn't make much difference in the long run where we ended up. But we, but when I came back, I here again through Adela Rogers, I guess she had it was she Adela Rogers St. John. She got me connected at the LA Examiner, so I went to work on the copy desk of the Los Angeles Examiner, which was.
This was 1954,
that's right.
Oh, 54.
54, right. Okay. And I stayed there until I went to Minnesota.
And you went to Minnesota what year?
56.
56.
So it was about, it was almost 2 years. And I worked on the copy desk of the LA Examiner.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to go to Minnesota? Why did you want to go back to graduate school, and why did you choose Minnesota?
Well, I think when I came back, I was still, you know, I still wanted to work in newspaper, but I guess I was beginning to feel that, I just didn't have that much in common with, or at least the papers I'd worked on, I hadn't been that impressed. In fact, I wasn't that impressed with journalism in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Times at that time was still, Los Angeles Times was still not a good paper at all. It was before, it was just starting to change when, about that time when Otis Chandler had, who I knew at Stanford as a matter of fact, that was just starting to make the changes that really turned it into a great newspaper. But then it was very parochial and very, very biased.
The changes he made, what did he do that made that?
Well, first of all, he spent money, you know, I mean, he got some good editors. Yeah, he got some first-rate editors. They got people from some of the good papers in the East. But they spent a lot of money, and they began to really cover the news well, and also cover international and national news much better. Up to that time, it was a very provincial paper. Very anti-labor, very right-wing Republican, and with a lot of sort of special interests that it catered to in L.A. And so Los Angeles Press generally really wasn't very good in those days. Mm-hmm. And that was part of my reasoning. And also, you know, I really didn't like working on the Examiner that much. Partly because, you know, it's a Hearst paper, it didn't. Their general outlook on life didn't appeal to me very much, but in some ways, technically, it was a pretty good paper. It was very good in the sense that it was well produced. They gave far too much attention to Hollywood and the sensational local papers, the kind of things that Hearst was interested in, but it was well edited in the sense that it was carefully edited. You know, there was not a lot of errors.
When you say the Hearst paper, there was an outlook. How was that conveyed in the paper? I mean, let's see, Hearst was still...
He had just died, I think. He died about 53.
53, okay.
So, but people around here would tell you how he used to, in his last years when he was living in Beverly Hills, and he lived at the beach home there at Santa Monica for a long time. With Marion Davies, and in his last years, she had a home in Beverly Hills where he stayed, and he used to call up and tell the editor he didn't like this, or he wants you to cover that, or whatever. the Hearst organization, aside from Hearst, even though Hearst was gone, there were still kind of certain kinds of stories that they were very interested in. And they had one reporter, I remember one reporter, very, very able reporter, a guy named Julian Hart, who was sort of, whenever there was a story that that Hearst organization had a real interest in, he was the guy that wrote the story. Mm-hmm. And he knew how to give it the spin that they were interested in.
Yeah. I've just been reviewing a documentary film that was done on the making of Citizen Kane.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And it really is a kind of a parallel story between Hearst and Orson Welles. And interesting some interesting footage of Hearst and type of individual he was. And
yeah, oh yeah. But he had a lot of, you know, and there was a lot of sort of Hearst maxims and so forth that were around, you know, that, I mean, that people would, the old timers on the paper would sort of. But one thing that Hearst was, you know, for instance, just an example of something, Hearst never believed in any kind of acronyms or abbreviations. He always wanted it spelled out. Mm-hmm. You don't under, people, a lot of people don't understand what the acronym means, you know, like NRA or
sure.
Or things have been done. Mm-hmm. And whereas the press is often very quick to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And, and you know, in a lot of ways, from the point of view of just practical journalism, he had a lot of very sound ideas. Mm-hmm. And,
in terms of making an interesting paper, yeah.
Yeah.
So you look to the University of Minnesota. You were dissatisfied with journalism. What led you to decide to go back to graduate school?
I think I was kind of had become interested in what was going on in schools of journalism. You know, mm-hmm. this whole interest in mass communications as a aspect of the whole field, rather than just the narrow training of journalists for jobs on newspapers, or just the concern with the newspapers as institutions, but looking for the wider implications of mass communication. So that was, you know, it was kind of getting, you know, I've been kind of aware of that sort of thing, and part of it I'd gotten from UCLA, but elsewhere, and I went to Stanford to see Chick Bush, who had been the head of the program there, and Harvard and I knew him very well, and we had sometimes gone and visited them at Stanford, he had said that good programs, you know, I was interested in going to Stanford, but the Stanford program, it was just really getting started then. They had just had not yet brought in, he was talking about bringing in Wilbur Schramm, mm-hmm. and they had not really started their program, but it was just started getting going, and I was interested in that, but it was also quite apparent that it was going to be a very highly quantitative kind of a program, with lots of statistics and mm-hmm. that sort of thing, and Bush, knowing me, he said, well, I think you might be better off in a place like Minnesota or Wisconsin. He said, those two programs. At that time, this would be 1956, or maybe 55, probably early 56, both those programs, PhD programs, were really just getting organized at both Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I applied to both places, mm-hmm. I didn't hear from Wisconsin.
Really?
I found out later that those days that Ralph Nafziger used to handle all the correspondence. It was a pretty small operation those days. Mm-hmm. He used to handle he personally would handle all the correspondence of people applying for graduate work. And he just never got around to answering my letter.
Oh, he did.
And whereas Minnesota was much more responsive, uh-huh.
Minnesota had a of course Nafziger had been in Minnesota
before then,
and when you went there in 1956, what kind of a program did they have? What was the?
Well, it was still kind of being worked out. But I think it was, the form was still pretty much there. There had been, I think there had been about four or five people had gone through. Bud Nelson was the first one to finish.
Yep. Bud would have been here at Wisconsin by then, wouldn't he?
Yeah, just about that time, yeah.
Did you know Bud before?
No.
Until you came here?
No, but I met him my last year at Minnesota when I was just getting ready to come down here. And he was up at Minnesota visiting Mitch Turner or something. I was just at a party where he was introduced, and they knew at that time I was going to Wisconsin. But Bud had you know, went to three different schools after he finished at Minnesota before he came here. He spent, you know, he was ABD, is without the dissertation, and he went to, he spent a year at Texas Tech and at Berkeley, but I think he was also at Iowa.
Might have been, okay.
Yeah, there were three places, one year each, and then the opening came up at Wisconsin. He wanted to come to Wisconsin, and so then he came here. And so, he was here 2 or 3 years before I came in '59. Yeah. But the PhD program at Minnesota then was pretty much pretty similar to what it was in later years. They had sort of had seven areas.
Okay.
Seven areas that in the PhD program, and I think you had to do four of the areas.
What were the areas? Just
well, I can, I don't know how many I can reel off, but there was one on sort of the mass communication institutions, which would cover law and social implications, like press and society and
mm-hmm.
law.
Mm-hmm.
There was one on history of journalism, one on sort of behavioral research or mass communications theory, I guess it was
mm-hmm.
called. And then there was some research methods and international communication, which Ray Nixon was really just getting started
mm-hmm.
and it didn't have much substance. And then there must have been something else sort of in the, they were getting into, then there was the propaganda and public opinion sort of thing.
Which was a separate area.
Yeah, that's right. Propaganda and public opinion, which covered some of these were sort of substantive areas and some were sort of methods areas, but you had to take four of the seven.
Did they have a distinction between the what we call, I suppose, a research track and a professional program for journalists then?
Well, no, but by the emphasis, you could go more one way than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was a good program in the sense that it sort of prepared you to teach in a variety of areas, you
mm-hmm.
know, that
mm-hmm.
and teach in several different. But it was unlike the Wisconsin program. It really didn't train you to do research, do a highly, you know, a very focused kind of a research thing where you would be trained to carry out research in one very specific area.
It was a broader program.
Yeah, that's right. And they were still. And also, you had to take a minor. In addition to this,
so it was
I took a minor outside of journalism was political science, and within the minor I had the sort of two fields within the minor. One was constitutional law,
mm-hmm.
which was very good, a year-long course and a seminar that really complemented the area interest I had in law and institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And law of the press.
Who taught that course?
A guy named Harold Chase, and he was a really fine guy,
uh-huh.
and very highly regarded person. Then the other was a political behavior, a seminar that was, I mean, it was a, there again, several courses in that area that, and then I had to take minors, I had to take exams in the minors in those
mm-hmm.
two areas.
It sounds as though the program was kind of built to ensure breadth.
Yeah.
And then when you came to the dissertation, you began to specialize.
That's right.
Didn't come
in a way, it was kind of taking, it was sort of responding to the interests of the faculty, too. You
know? Yeah.
Faculty had different teaching or areas of research interests of their own, and so you sort of, it gave you an opportunity to work with any, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because each one of those areas, you had one faculty member who was really sort of the key person in there.
Yeah.
You might take two or three courses from him, and also you might do a dissertation with that.
The four areas that you chose, what were they?
I think I can remember these. But I'd have to look at my...
Go back and look at your notes.
Look at my, yeah, right. I know I took mass media institution, which was law, which was Ed Gerald's area, mm-hmm. and which was law and sort of the press and society area. And I took theory of mass communication, which was we kind of covered a lot of the, but this was the readings and in the area of a lot of the research on mass communication research, and that was getting more active. Also, the press and society, the propaganda and public opinion area, which was sort of Casey's area, because mm-hmm. he'd been
Ralph Casey,
the director mm-hmm. of the school, and then the guy who'd been sort of a big research figure in that area. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other was sort of the research methods, and which involved several courses. You know, research methods. You know that I love Bob Jones, who was later the director of the school and was sort of a person and well prepared to do all kinds of communication research. We had the course on sort of the research methods course. We used used punch cards. You know, the mm-hmm. the IBM punch cards were the equivalent of the computer in those days for computer research. And
well, did you the computer was you were using computers?
No, it was just it was a card. It was a key punch. It was a card shorting thing.
Oh, I see.
It wasn't a computer by any means, but it was a way of doing research. You know that you would.
Had there been any thought about using computers in that period?
Well, not at that time.
Computers were around, but they were as big as this room.
Yeah, that's right. And if any, only people that were doing that would have been people in the sciences and stuff that had access to them. So, you know, and statistics, you know, you were, in those days, you were expected, if there were going to be statistics in your dissertation, you were expected to take the courses in statistics and do them yourself, you know.
Outside of the program.
Well, you would take, it'd be part of your own
work. Oh, you mean you do your own statistics?
Do your own statistics for the dissertation. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty strong kind of thing in a PhD program, that you did your own statistics. But then not too long after that, I guess, you know, then you had situations where somebody else would do the statistical analysis you but you know, without computers and so forth, the statistics could be pretty slow. Slow process.
Sure. And still using a slide rule and various other things. Who were the? If you had to list the people in Minnesota who were the most influential for you, who were the people in the department you were most influenced by or worked most closely with in Minnesota?
Yeah. Well, Ed Gerald was one that was really. And interesting that both Bud and I, who were there at different times, both felt he was the one that was the most useful, you know, most helpful to us. And he taught the law of the press, mm-hmm. of course, the law areas before Gilmore came there. And he also taught the seminars in that area. He also taught a course called The Press as a Social Institution, mm-hmm. which was sort of the ethical, legal aspects of the press, and very much equivalent to the course. What became a big course here was the Mass Communication Society. Wisconsin had this Mass Communication Society course, you know, for many years, and that was
where did that begin here?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. You know, I think the way it began here was in the senior thesis, mm-hmm. You know, in the one of the storerooms around here. They've still got this.
Oh, sure, they're right over here.
Yeah, right. Well, every senior, you know, as part of the degree requirement was to write a senior thesis, mm-hmm. And they were usually dealing with some aspect of either press performance or history or whatever. Some aspect of often some kind of an aspect of media performance. And everybody did that, and then that became formed, and I think you did that within a course. You had a course, then everybody wrote a senior thesis. Mm-hmm. Then I think that evolved into the Mass Communication Society course, which began a course that looked at the ethical and not legal, but sort of quasi-legal and mm-hmm.
the impact of technology on society, or I've always liked the title of that. It's broad enough to where you can talk about a range of aspects of society.
Right. But Ed Gerald was a key person. Casey was a very influential person too. But he was near the end of his career. His career. He retired halfway through my 3 years in Minnesota, and he had a very powerful personality and one of the real leaders in journalism, the history of journalism education. Mm-hmm. But he was a very, also at the same time, a very irascible and commanding kind of a guy. Mm-hmm. You know, all kinds of, you know, the stories that can be told about Casey. One period for about 10 years, you know, after that, you know, in AEJs and so forth, you talk to former students mm-hmm. who'd been at Minnesota. You know, they would all, invariably, the conversation would come to Casey, and everybody tried to top each other with some stories of Casey's.
Such as, can you think of an example?
Well, the sort of thing, you know, it was well known
that he, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he would, from his home, he would call up his office and ask the secretary, tell the secretary to go around to all the faculty offices and see if everybody's in their office. And if they weren't, he wanted to know about it. Uh-huh. And he expected everybody there to be in their office at 8 o'clock, but he would come in a little later. Uh-huh. But that was typical Casey. He would try to rule with an iron hand, you mm-hmm. know. And yet he was a strong figure, and he established journalism in Minnesota in a very, very, mm-hmm. very clear fashion, and really made it an institution, you know, that way that. I was hired. I came there with a TA ship, which paid $1,500, and I was, after I'd been given the TA ship, the teacher assistant ship, I was received a letter that they decided they didn't want me to be a TA ship; they wanted me to be an administrative assistant to Casey. So I came there as an administrative assistant my first year, mm-hmm. and just working. So I was working for him. He was 2 years from retirement, that, or maybe just a year and a half from retirement, so I was to help him and do the things, whatever he wanted me to do, you know, because mm-hmm. he'd seen I'd had newspaper experience, and I was a little older than the average graduate student. I'd had more mm-hmm. outside experience, but one of the things he did, you know, example of Casey's arbitrariness, that I had put in an application for there was kind of a small housing for graduate students on the St. Paul campus there were a few apartments available, but they were furnished mm-hmm. for graduate students. And I had applied for this, and I had good hopes of getting it. And I was told that I couldn't get in. And I found out later, so I couldn't get in, so it meant that we had to bring furniture from California and rented a small apartment near campus, mm-hmm. Which was a big outlay for us, you know, mm-hmm. to have to bring all the furniture to furnish an apartment. I found out later that Casey didn't want me to stay in that apartment. He didn't think it was appropriate for his administrative assistant to be in that apartment. So he canceled my application. That and on his own, you know.
Yeah. It's a kind of a mentality that would be very hard to survive in this day and age, I suspect.
That's right. I mean, his type. But
he was not really. Who was he responsible to? To a dean or to? He was not responsible to the faculty. I mean, there was, in terms of faculty governance.
The faculty governance. In fact, when he retired, you know, it's the people. When he retired. Right at the time he retired, in fact, when he gave over, while they were still in the process of naming his successor, that the faculty passed rules that made it very tough for his successors to do the kind of things that he did. And it was a real slap at Casey that this was done. But Gerald in particular was one that just fought him, and other faculty members had to a lesser, greater or lesser degree. So it was a real contentious thing. But you know, the thing that is, and Knapsinger, of course, who'd worked with them for years and all, could tell you all the crazy Casey stories, but he still admired him, and felt he was one of the seminal figures in journalism education. Because for one thing, you know, he had guts. You know, he would really stick up for something he believed in, and he would take on the administration or anybody else that would, or who got his way. And so, you know, he accomplished a great deal from the administrative point of view.
As a graduate student, when you went through, I assume you had qualifying exams, and were these written exams and in oral exams, combination of the two? How did that work?
You had to take a written exam each one of those four areas.
Now, did you select the professor, or did the I assume
the only thing you really selected was your thesis advisor.
I guess my question is, in terms of the exams, was there a committee that the school set up to prepare exam questions, or was this more of an individualized sort
of thing? There weren't that many PhD students around, so you sort of did it at your own. You know, when you were ready for exams, then you did
it. Individually.
And I think there was one faculty member in charge of each one of those
areas.
Mm-hmm. And then he would write the question.
And
for
then you would write, and was there an oral exam after that?
Yeah, that's right. You had the. Well, no, not an oral exam at that point. No, you had a written exam on all of the four areas, and they would be read by your committee. There was a committee that would read all of them. You know,
all four questions.
All four questions. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And so, then at the time the thesis was done, you had the final oral. You know, was based on the thesis. And
So the oral came after the thesis and not after the exam.
That's right. That's right. No oral at the time of the.
Yeah.
that's right. And but also I had to take written exams in the political science too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting in political science that they let you use a typewriter, but I took them with several other, they were scheduled at a certain date for the ones in political behavior, the ones in constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
And so you took it at the, there might be half a dozen other political science students who would be taking the same exams.
Mm-hmm.
But they let me use a typewriter, which wasn't that common, you know. And I was still close enough to newspaper work that I could really type fast, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lost that facility, but I really, at that time, I really had
it. Well, it made a big difference in trying to write things in longhand.
Sure. And I just turned out a hell of a lot of copy, it's one of those things you lose.
The dissertation, now, what did you choose to write your dissertation?
Well, it's a funny thing. I much as I admired Gerald, and Bud was the same way about him, we both admired him a lot, but... I was very leery about doing a dissertation with him because he was a very demanding guy, you know, and very high standards, so I sort of avoided him. But I did work with Ray Nixon, and Ray Nixon was the one who was my thesis advisor, and very nice guy, and still alive. You know, was in his 90s something.
Now his area was.
Well, he was international, and also he sort of did the theory area. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't get much help on thesis topics, and that's one of the shortcomings of that program. But I finally decided to do something on, because he also did the research area. I did a study of a content analysis of Sunday newspapers, looked at, you know, analyzed, you know, using content analysis, and this is before computers, and content analysis is just a deadly thing to do, because everybody always said anybody did content analysis those days, did one and that was it. You never wanted to do one again because it was a very time-consuming thing, because I did an analysis of a lot of papers. Mm-hmm. I looked at it both historically, but I did analysis of major metropolitan Sunday papers over a period of 20 years, I guess, and I spent a lot of time. I hadn't finished it at the time I came here. I came here at ABD, but I spent a lot of time in the Historical Society looking at volumes of mostly bound volumes of papers, plus a few, some were on microfilm. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, that's always been something that has puzzled me, how you deal with a newspaper. I mean, the content is obviously the important, very important part of the newspaper, and yet there's so much of it in terms of just being able to the sheer volume of it, and I've never been comfortable with the kinds of studies that, you know, you just simply counted headlines or number of times something was mentioned. And
yeah, I know.
So it really does pose a very challenging kind of problem in terms of how you evaluate a newspaper and what it means.
That's right. Well, you know, in the 30s, I mean, the 50s at that time, content analysis was pretty much in vogue. There was a lot of different content analysis going on, even though the mechanics of doing it were still pretty laborious, you know. Mm-hmm. There were some important international studies, you know, comparing content across countries, and there were a lot of being done. But I admit there were a lot of problems, and there was also the problems of how qualitative you would be, you know, whether you're strictly quantitative and count things, or whether you try to take in consideration
Was there a particular area that you focused on in the Sunday papers? I mean, that you were interested over others, reporting,
I was trying to look at it as a sort of a separate aspect of journalism it was compared with I guess I had one chapter on what was like papers abroad. That, you know, the British, for instance, the Sunday paper is often quite a separate publication from the daily paper. Different. Completely different staff, even though it may be the same ownership, you have a completely different staff. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was kind of looking at I haven't looked at that thing for a long time, but you know, that was an example of content analysis. You lose your interest in
do it again.
Even go back and do it again, and I think that's happened. You don't see much content analysis being done, and
no.
At least in the way it was approached in those times.
Yeah. You finished you were ABD when you got your first job out of graduate school, is that right?
Yeah,
came where?
Here. That's right. I should say while I was in that last semester while I was there, Ralph Napster had come up to visit the campus, and he had a lot of friends who had been on the campus, been on the staff there for a number of years, you know, it was from 35 to 49 or something like that, and before he came down to start the program here. So he knew a lot of people there, but he came to my office. Ray Nixon was my advisor and had introduced me to him and sort of got me lined up with Ralph. I was looking at I was trying to get a job at this thing, finishing up that year. Mm-hmm. Then the invitation, you know, came from Ralph. I tried a couple other places. Penn State, I guess, was one possibility, and I forget where else, but it's also sort of interesting in retrospect that the letter, I got sort of a letter of offer from Ralph that was typed out by himself on a typewriter, just a letter offering me the job, and I forget the salary, it was very minimal sort of salary, you know. But I never filled out any kind of, and then I accepted it and came, but I never received any kind of I've never filled out any kind of a form, you know, like
Written contract, yeah.
Or even a information form, you know, like your name, your previous experience, and all your life history and so forth. So I finished up in the spring of '59. I finished the exams. I'd gotten started on my dissertation. I was sort of about halfway into it, but I really needed to get a, I wanted to get a job and get
so
out.
So you came here for the fall of 59?
Fall of 59, that's right.
And
ABD. And I came at, as an instructor because that since I didn't have the PhD in hand, that that wouldn't make me, I couldn't come as an assistant professor.
Yeah. I was going to have a question here and it slipped my mind real quick. Well, okay, you came here in fall of 59. What did you teach when you came here?
Well, I taught a reporting class, beginning reporting class, started that. Also, you know, the fact that I was hadn't the dissertation, that they sort of took it easy on me the first year on the assignments. And but I also taught, I was supposed to... Where were we last time? We were just finishing...
Yeah, well, let me start here. This is Stephen Vaughn, and we're continuing... the interview with Bill Hackton, Professor Bill Hackton. It's July the 16th, 1996. This is a continuation of the interview that began on July the 10th. And last time we had gotten up to about the early 1950s, and when you started graduate school, I guess maybe I ought to start off by asking if there were some things you thought of last time in the material that we covered that you wanted to add, or anything that we didn't cover that you thought might be worth covering in the period up before 1950?
No, I guess nothing really comes to mind right now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, why don't we today maybe explore your graduate training, because you said, I believe it was 1951 that you went to graduate school. Was it at UCLA?
Yeah. Right.
And perhaps we could talk a little bit about your experiences in graduate school and more generally about the field of communication and journalism, mass communication, teaching and research. Why did you choose UCLA?
Well, UCLA was close by. That was one thing. I was living in Huntington Park at the time, and I had come back from a trip to Europe, as a matter of fact. A college friend and I had gone on an 8-month trip through Europe on bicycles and had traveled around.
This was in what year?
1950.
What was, just to digress a little bit, what was Europe like in 1950? This was the period of the Marshall Plan,
yeah,
and the rebuilding of Europe after World War II.
Yeah, it was fascinating to be there because of the fact that Europe was still in very difficult plight. For one thing, they've not begun to recover from the war yet, and particularly in Germany. And in Germany, riding our bicycles through the Rhineland, and particularly in Hamburg, going through Hamburg, just mile after mile on all sides, everything just leveled, just completely leveled. But, you know, the thing that impressed you, too, was the fact that the industrious Germans were working. They were cleaning up the rubble and going to work, and you could see it wasn't going to be long before they'd be right back in things. But France was in terrible shape, too, and didn't have as much war damage, but the economy now was very prostrate. And England was still very much under rationing and was having a very difficult time economically. But from the point of view of an American, it was Europe was extremely cheap, you know, because the dollar was so strong, and the European economies were just still quite flattened.
You traveled through Germany, France, England, any other countries that you?
Yeah, well, we also went up into Scandinavia, and most of that time we were through the northern countries. We were riding bikes. It was a very cheap way to do it because my friend from Stanford just didn't have any money at all. We were really living cheap, and we were staying at youth hostels. Youth hostel system was pretty widespread all through Northern Europe, and so for 25 cents you could stay at a hostel, and 25 cents you'd get a good meal at the hostel. And that is
quite cheap compared to today, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no comparison. And so, but then we did take the trains at part of the time, and But we later went to Italy, and Italy, the thing that we remember about Italy is every railroad station, we went to mainly by train through Italy, and part of the summer was coming on, it was getting very hot, but every railroad station was gone, you know, because that was always the target. The targets were the railroad stations mm-hmm. in every town, and most places they hadn't been rebuilt. The railroads were running, but the stations were not rebuilt. They also went to Spain, and Spain was fascinating because that time the Franco was still the Franco regime was still in power, and you were going into a fascist country that had been essentially cut off from Europe, cut off from the rest of the world for a long time. And
was it difficult to get into Spain? Or
no, you had to get a visa. Mm-hmm. You had to get a visa, and it wasn't difficult, but it was a very fascinating place to go, and in part because the Spaniards had been so cut off mm-hmm. from the West, and of course the Franco regime and the police state mentality was still very much mm-hmm. in control.
Well, this was then the spring and summer of 1950.
Yeah. But then I came back, I was sort of unsure of whether I wanted to go back into newspaper work at that time. Jobs were still hard to come by, and in part because there was still the big backlog of veterans who were coming out of universities, so I decided to get a master's in journalism. I thought that UCLA was close by, so they had a 1 year at that time. They had a 1 year master's program in journalism, and you could get a degree in 1 year, and so I decided to go there.
Yeah, there was no PhD program yet at UCLA.
No, PhD programs were just starting to be talked about, but nobody was really there. I think they were, that was coming a little later, 3 or 4 years later at Minnesota and Wisconsin and other places were starting to do. But it was fascinating, that this whole, you could see the beginning then of this sort of interest in the broader communications aspect, or mass communications, mm-hmm. rather than just featured journalism. And at the UCLA program, which was a 1 year program, and it was really very much the brainchild of a man named Joe Brandt, who was sort of outside the mainstream of the other journalism program. Incidentally, it's a program that Steve Chaffee went through several years after I did mm-hmm. and got a master's.
Master's in journalism?
Yeah. And, the thing that was kind of, we had one course, it was called Mass Communications. It was sort of these were all graduate students. There were probably about 20 graduate students in this program. But this one course, one semester course, it was 2 or 3 credits. It was called Mass Communications, and it was taught by a man named Franklin Fearing, F-E-A-R-I-N-G.
Sure.
Yeah. You know the name?
Yeah. Well, I remember him from World War II and some of my own research.
Oh,
He did some studies, if I recall, on film audiences and psychological warfare. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And he was a social psychologist.
Uh-huh.
And quite an impressive guy, and but I just recently came across his reading list for that course,
uh-huh.
and this was 1951, and that reading list for that course was mostly studies in social psychology, but it was on propaganda and public opinion, some public opinion stuff, and some of the social psychology experiments and stuff that were coming out at that time, and that became kind of integrated into communications programs, mm-hmm. into journalism communications programs mm-hmm. later. And so I was sort of impressed because that reading list that he gave mm-hmm. that time is one that would hold up 10 or 15 years later. Mm-hmm. It was certainly at the program in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Now, he was the person who ran the journalism program, or he was the person you worked with?
Who?
Fearing.
Oh, no, he just taught one course. He just taught a course.
I see.
And to the graduate students. And he was in the psych department. But he was interested in mass communications. And so the field was starting to gather momentum or get identity. And because it was, in those early years in particular, it was drawing from a lot of different different sources that were kind of coming together.
What were your impressions? What was Fearing like as a classroom teacher?
Well, he was, you know, he was a guy who also had some problems with loyal deals, I think, too. But I forget just exactly what it was, but you know, the University of California had the loyal deals thing. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, that was very common in the early 50s.
Big controversy within the University of California system, and I think he had refused to sign any loyal deals, and he got into problems with it. And I really don't know the details, but I know that, and I think that he'd been very much involved in what would be considered not radical politics, but at least more liberal politics at that time. And, he was an impressive man, and I don't think I really appreciated him so much at the time, but I realized, in retrospect, I realized that this was a...
Did he draw on his experiences in World War II in his classroom?
No, not that I... No,
it was different, different set of...
But he was, you know, it, I realized later when I got more into this sort of thing that he was really beginning to define the field, and it was a good example of, you know, that later you can... Well, Schramm, of course, did a... Later was the one who kind of called the great synthesizer. He kind of drew all these threads together and was very much responsible for sort of identifying it as a, if not a... not a discipline, at least a pretty discrete field, and that was part of the growing excitement of the of that time period was that it was really beginning in the 50s and it extended all through the 50s and 60s of a sense of excitement, sort of a new important field was coming into being and research was coming from a lot of sources, you know, from sociologists and political scientists, and a lot of it was kind of war-related things, you know, that and that had been, and also as I saw later in Minnesota, that a lot of the World War One research, of course, you know, was fed into.
Well, I would imagine the Cold War also had was an impetus for some of the research questions that came out of
that. That's right.
Period,
that's
too.
Right. Yeah. Sure. At that time, you know, there was a study that was done that Wilbur Schramm did a study. I don't know if you're aware of it. A small book called The Reds Take a... I think it was called The Reds Take a City, and it was a study. I think it was a study of the Korean War and the role of the communist armies and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it was a very strong, outspoken Cold War. A gung-ho Cold War kind of a study, you know, that really reflected the times, the times. And his later career, and Steve talked about this too, Chafee, that Schramm never really referred to this book very often.
Didn't want to acknowledge it, perhaps. But now, Fearing's course, what did he have you do? I mean, was this... You said he had problems with loyalty oaths and so forth. I gather he was not as ardent a Cold Warrior.
Over into the classroom. That's right. It was mainly in the social psychology area, you know, and I guess I would have a little trouble getting very much more in detail later. But the thing that really struck me in finding the the reading list was that you could see the how the thing was being drawn, how things were being drawn together. And then later, about 5 years, 6 years later, when I was at Minnesota, when you see the reading list, you know, the reading list in the field of the growing field of mass communications research and so forth, and the so-called classic studies, a lot of those kind of books were on the list. And
sure.
A lot of the World War II stuff, like Psych War, a marvelous book that Daniel Lerner did about his experiences in the army, where they were doing these psych war. They called it psych war, and it was really combat sort of attempt to confuse or divert the enemy.
Psychological warfare
carried on in the combat area, you know, not just through radio or anything. Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the other people that you came in contact with at UCLA when you were there?
Well, It was, well, Joe Brandt himself was a fascinating guy. That he had been a book publisher. He was a Rhodes, had been a Rhodes Scholar, and he was head of a book. He'd been the head of Henry Holt and University of Chicago Press. And he's a native Oklahoman, and then he was the and then he was the head of the University of Oklahoma Press at a time when it was quite important press, and then he became president of the University of Oklahoma, and he was president of the University of Oklahoma for some years, and but also had a newspaper background. He'd worked, I think, for the Oklahoma City papers, but then he sold the university on the idea of a 1-year program and 1-year master's program in journalism. And
was this oriented primarily towards print media, or more generally towards?
It was very much toward print media, with some attention to radio. Uh-huh. And there were a couple, one small course on radio, but the great emphasis was on newspapers, magazines. Television was 1951. Television was really not starting to play much of a factor. It was coming in, of course, but mm-hmm. there wasn't much in the way of teaching. But they had one very interesting course that I always thought was very valuable. It was called The Ideas That Changed History. And this was kind of, Brandt had been very much influenced by the great books ideas.
Mortimer Adler and
was it St. John's College and some of the other places that had the whole curriculum was based upon reading great books. Well, this was a two semester course, it was sort of dealing with important ideas all the way through history that had affected history. And the way it was designed was this: about 20 of us in this program. You would each week you would read a book, and it was a book a week, so it was pretty demanding reading. And all of us were having trouble keeping up with the reading as well as the other courses we had to do. But you'd read one book, like Plato's Republic or the Quran or things from Marx. It was part of Marx's Das Kapital, all the way through modern Western civilization, and then you would. But the technique was that you would get together, and Brandt and another colleague would usually have two instructors, and the instructors would ask questions, but they would never answer. That was the role of the instructor, to never answer, never give their own opinions, but mm-hmm. to just keep asking questions, mm-hmm. and then the students would respond and argue among themselves and so forth, but you'd never, the person leading the instructor would never. Mm-hmm. And it was a very stimulating kind of an intellectual activity.
So this was part of the 1-year program.
One of the 1-year program, that's right. And then you came all the way through, you know, you went through things like Admiral Mann's, you know, the great theorist on, strategist on power of sea power.
Oh yeah, Alfred Theremahan, the influence of sea power in history.
Right. And as well as Paul Sears, he wasn't a man as well known, but he had written a book on the effects of the Dust Bowl and effect, and it was one of the early books on the effects to the environment, you know, mm-hmm. and how overplowing or misuse of the environment had led to. But it was a very stimulating kind of course. You can say, well, this doesn't have much to do with journalism, but it's dealing with important ideas and good intellectual training. You know,
yeah, I would. Well, I would think it would have a good deal to do with journalism in a broad sense, in terms of giving you a perspective and a background from mm-hmm. which to set contemporary problems.
Yeah, right, that's right.
What were the other courses?
The other courses they also had kind of a simulation. They had a simulation of a newsroom, and there was a guy named Kirby Ramsdale, who was the editorial page editor of the LA Times, who would come in once a week, and then he'd sort of run run a copy desk. But during the week, the students were assigned stories to do and outside, mm-hmm. somewhat like the Columbia thing, doing stories out in the community. Mm-hmm. Then they'd send their stories in, and then some of the class or most of the class would become a copy desk, and they'd edit these stories mm-hmm. and write headlines on them and so forth. And Kirby would run this sort of a practicum. It was a practicum on mm-hmm. Simulating a newspaper situation, and so that. Then there was also one course, a small course on law of the press. It was kind of fascinating at that time. There wasn't that much law of the press, mm-hmm. mainly the course was mainly just concerned with the problems of libel, and it was about 75% libel. There was very little. It may have been partly due to the guy that taught, who was a practicing attorney and a very able guy, but. He wasn't, we hardly at all got any kind of First Amendment considerations. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that really kind of came along with it.
Do you remember who the person was that taught that?
No. He was a practicing attorney. He wasn't a member of the UCLA faculty.
I would think in the 50, early 50s that First Amendment wasn't a popular topic, if you were, but at the same time, there were a lot of people who did some very significant research on the First Amendment.
But that really, that came along. And there's a good example. There's a good example, I think, of the role that schools of journalism have played. That they really, by attention to legal concerns, like Bud Nelson did with Bud
sure,
Nelson
Bud's
and
first,
Peter,
yeah,
but and Don Gilmore at Minnesota. See, it's interesting that the textbook, the standard textbook that was taught, that was used by Frank Thayer, who was on the faculty here for many, many years and got a master's here in 1916, but became a lawyer, was a lawyer, and his book, which was for many years practically the only textbook in the legal area, was called Legal Control of the Press. Mm-hmm. And that was the book that Nelson took over, and when Frank retired, and changed it into. But the whole focus was the legal controls on the press, not the idea of
freedom
of the press or.
Well, that's an interesting idea, I guess, the role that journalism schools had in broadening the definition of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And increasing an appreciation for the First Amendment. I hadn't really thought about it. about it in that way.
And also, of course, the times are changing, but the whole idea of communication law was mm-hmm. hardly existed, but there were sort of strands of it in various places,
sure.
like the legal, FCC controls on broadcasting, censorship has existed as such, and mm-hmm. what it did on the entertainment media. There were some things on copyright and trademark. Mm-hmm. But these were all kind of scattered pieces that nobody much had brought together. So that the whole idea of communication law is something that's very, and I think schools of journalism had a lot to do with it. And in part, and also people in the press themselves were not very much aware of what their legal rights mm-hmm. were and so forth. And, mm-hmm. The role of
Were there any other courses there in that MA program that come to mind? Were these courses that you were required to take, or did you have a choice in terms of picking?
Well, there was a little bit. There were a few sort of couple courses. For instance, the second semester, on this practicum, the practicum that we that went for two semesters. And I had newspaper experience. I'd worked for 2 years at Santa Paula on this paper, this small paper in Southern California, Santa Paula Chronicle. And because of that, I was sort of excused from it, and I was given the option of writing a master's thesis, which is what I did the second semester.
Oh, you did. What did you write on?
I wrote on sports pages.
Oh, okay. Well, what was the gist of your thesis?
It was pretty, not very theoretical or very low level kind of stuff, but I think Joe Brandt was the main one advising me on it. But what I did was to I did. It was partly sort of a history of the sports pages in American journalism history, and but also I sent a questionnaire to the sports editors of about 15 or 20 major dailies around the country, and asked them a whole series of questions about sports pages and which papers have the best sports pages, and which have the best reporters, and who are the best sports columnists around, and so forth, and what are the shortcomings and strengths of sports journalism, and so on, and it was kind of interesting to hear from all these people, you know, and so I wrote a little master's thesis on that, for instance, who do you think was rated at that time the most popular sports writer?
Oh, gee, Haywood Hailbrun?
No, it was a little after his. Well, he was still around, I guess, but he wasn't. It was Red Smith, who was again and again, you know, he was considered the number one and a very fine writer at that, and there are also names around, some which may not be familiar, but a guy named Jimmy Cannon, the New York.
Sure, I remember reading some of his stuff in the 60s, I think.
Yeah.
He covered boxing quite a bit, if I remember.
And a very fine writer. Yeah, you know, very fine writer. And boxing, I just saw a line that he wrote that about Joe Louis. You know, one of the things that was sort of the condescending things they were always saying about Joe Louis was that he was a credit to his race.
Mm-hmm.
And Cannon said, yeah, he's a credit to his race, to the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a good line. I think you, our former student Bruce Evanson, has just done a book on sports reporting in the 20s.
Oh, is that right? Oh.
Mm-hmm. On the way reporters covered the Dempsey-Tunney fight.
Mm, mm, mm,
and how that kind of created a cult of celebrity and
stuff. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a very interesting area, I think, to cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, you know, it's that period when publicity and promotion of sports figures became,
sure.
You had all of the, you know, that's when the hero making was taking place.
Yeah.
Babe Ruth and, you know, almost every sport there were these sort of major figures. Who's the big golfer?
Bobby Jones.
Bobby Jones.
Yeah
Bobby Jones, sure. and all the sports writers.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was. But also because I'd played, you know, I'd been in athletics and so forth. I was that sort of.
Well, I think sport history has grown into quite a an area of research now. Particularly in the last quarter of a century, it's been a. You know, just studying the phenomenon of sport.
Yeah. As an aspect of popular culture.
Popular culture, exactly.
Cultural influence.
Because it's really a worldwide phenomenon.
Right. And in a lot of ways, you know, it has spread from America, of course. Other countries have had their interest in sport, but American approach to
I remember being over when we were at Tashkent, which was a city of about 2 million in Uzbekistan, Central Asia, and they had a huge soccer stadium there. Must have seated 40,000 or 50,000 people, and they had a big horse racing track. So you know, sports, horse racing and soccer were two constants that went around.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in 1992, I guess, three. We were in Soviet Union, or Russia, and we're way up in the north, north of St. Petersburg at this small town, Petrozaversk, I guess. And I was waiting for my wife, who was shopping, and these young kids came up, and they knew a little English and wanted to try it on me, and they said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from a city near Chicago. Oh, Chicago! Michael Jackson, Chicago Bulls.
Michael Jackson,
Well,
they probably knew Michael Jackson.
Michael Jordan. And but they knew him, you know, and that was a very quick response.
Yeah.
And
well, they would have known Michael Jackson also.
Yeah, that's
I remember
right.
When I was there seeing a video recording of Michael Jackson out in we were way up in the mountains there, and our host had a VCR. And a copy of one of Michael Jackson's tapes, and we watched it. Yeah, so Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Okay, you finished up your master's program in 1952, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Was this a two-semester, or were they in the
Yeah, two semesters. Yeah, I got it two semesters.
And then what did you do in 52?
52, I went to work for the Long Beach Press Telegram. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the instructors there at UCLA, the last semester, and she was teaching kind of a feature writing course, I guess, is Adela Rogers St. Johns. I don't know if you know the name, Adela Rogers.
No, the name, Johns. But I don't.
Yeah, well, she was the daughter of Earl Rogers, who was a famous criminal lawyer in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But she became a journalist, and a Hearst journalist, and she had quite a career as a Hearst journalist. And particularly, she covered the Lindbergh trial for Hearst and worked in New York, and was a real feature writer. But then she later went into movie writing, writing movie scenarios, and wrote a number of movie scripts. But she always kept that touch with journalism, and quite a fabulous person, and but anyway, she was responsible. She got me the job through her help. I got the job in Long Beach Press Telegram because she knew the editor, a guy named uh-huh. Hank Burmaster, and she called him up and
she knew you before.
She knew me as a student there. She was the teacher in the class. She taught. She sort of came in once a week and sort of held a feature writing class with them.
At UCLA,
that's right, okay. At UCLA. Uh-huh. But she was kind of a fascinating person, and actually knew everybody, and she knew all the people in Hollywood, and she was sort of tied in with all that celebrity thing. In fact, she had been married at one time to Dick Hyland, who was a sports writer in the Los Angeles Times, who had been quite a football player at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Very, very well-known football player, and one of her several. She had five or six marriages, and she had quite a career. But anyway, she sort of took a liking to me, and she got me. She was instrumental in getting this job on the Long Beach Press Telegram, which was.
You were on the Press Telegram how long?
I was there for about 2 years, I guess.
From 52 to 54.
Yeah, 54. And then, my wife and I were living in Beverly Hills, and I wanted to the poor part of Beverly Hills, not the but I was tired of that daily commute. This was commuting from Beverly Hills to to Long Beach Press Telegram mm-hmm. at a time when no freeways or anything, mm-hmm. and. I did a whole variety of things at the Press Telegram, and it was a very good kind of a place to get some journalism experience. They at that time they had two papers. There were two papers: the Press Telegram and the Independent, which was the morning paper. The Press Telegram was the afternoon paper, and they were covering beats on a round the clock basis, and so they put me. After I'd been there for a while, they put me on the police beat from the 11 at night to 7 a.m. beat, the overnight beat. Mm-hmm. And so it was terrible. I was sleeping and everything else, you know, that I had to drive down to Long Beach in the evening. Of course, the traffic wasn't so bad then, but I'd go to work at 11 at night, then I'd go to the police station and hang around and whatever came up. And also I had to... They taught me how to use a camera. It was the Speed Graphic at those times. You mm-hmm. know the Speed Graphic is sort of a big box-like camera that you could use slides that you slide the film in and out. You didn't have to. You didn't use a roll of film. You use slides. These sort of 6x8.
I know
you would push it in, and then you could take the picture. Then you just develop that. You didn't have to get a whole roll. Uh-huh. But I would. I had that. They showed me how to use that camera, you know, and I would. If there was a bad accident at night or something, they needed to take a picture of somebody, I would.
With a flashbulb, usually.
With a flashbulb. Yeah. That's right. That's right. I remember one. I think it was a New Year's Eve. I had to work on New Year's Eve, and there had been a carload of sailors, about five sailors, had crashed into this train. The train was crossing, crashed into the engine. And I was there at the scene right soon afterwards, and everybody was killed. Everybody in the car was killed. But I had, you know, taken these pictures of the, and that was.
Was that fairly cumbersome technology to carry around?
I mean, oh yeah, that's right. And but it was, it was the physical difficulties of carrying, and also it was the very difficult thing of trying to report something to take pictures at the same time. Mm-hmm. And most good papers didn't do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And
so you didn't have a photographer that went with you?
Well, no. They had staff photographers, but because of being on late at night and so forth, and they didn't keep many. I'm not even sure they had any photographers on duty that overnight. And, mm-hmm. and so, but later, you know, that's the sort of thing that would. But you know, you still see it done, you know, in a certain sense that if you look at newspapers or magazines, like sometimes a foreign correspondent will cover a story in, like in Tashkent or something. Mm-hmm. But you'll see he took the picture too, you know, that where he and he'll get credit for the picture. Yeah. But oftentimes they'll arrange for somebody else to cover the picture or hire something. You know.
So you covered police beat, but you covered other types of reporting.
Yeah, right? A lot of sort of feature writing, small feature stories, mm-hmm. sort of local feature stories. Mm-hmm. And also I was on, because of my football background, they put me on the sports page for a while too, and so I was covering sports mm-hmm. for a while too.
Was this professional or college?
Well,
or?
It was just the local sports, you know. It was for Long Beach was, you know, about 15 miles from Los Angeles, and it had a lot of sort of its own local mm-hmm. local sports. Mm-hmm. But the one thing they did do, you know, one thing that I sort of got involved back in pro football for a bit was that the L.A. Rams, which were pretty good in those days, 1954-55, Elroy Hirsch was playing for them, and they had pretty good teams. They won a couple championships, and they played their first exhibition game each year in Long Beach. So they sent me out to the. I spent about a week, two seasons, out at the Redlands training camp, and wrote stories. And there again, I took pictures. I took pictures that they ran, and also I had a chance to see Elroy Hirsch, who I had not seen since El Toro days.
Uh-huh.
He was at the time was becoming kind of a.
Well,
he made a couple movies too.
Yeah, he made a couple movies, if
that's
I recall,
right.
And
that's right.
Was not that bad of an actor, if I remember. Yeah,
yeah, he made one movie, a football movie, but then made another movie about being a troubled youth that went to jail and but anyway, that.
We might back up a minute. You mentioned you were married at this time. When did you meet Harva?
Yeah, well, this is the story. I didn't bring this in, but Harva was an instructor at UCLA when I was a student, and she had worked for several newspapers. She had worked more recently, Los Angeles Daily News, but so she had met Brandt and was an instructor so she was on the faculty So we got to know each other during that year, and then after the end of the year, and we got married later in that year. So she was still teaching at UCLA when I was at Long Beach,
Was she from California originally? Or?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she was born in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. From the same area and everything.
Yeah, though we didn't know each other until UCLA.
Yeah. And you got married in what year?
19 August of 52.
Yeah, which would have been. This was right before. It'd been right after you.
After the year.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, after the year.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So you've spent 52 to 54 with the Long Beach paper, and then from there, where did you go?
Yeah, well, then at that point, I'd been wanting to get into to editing, and I decided that the way up in a newspaper is through the copy desk, mm-hmm. and so I had there was a chance came up to on the copy desk editing job on that Long Beach Press Santa Monica Outlook, and which is a smaller paper than the Long Beach one, but a pretty good little regional small town paper. It's still going, as a matter of fact, I think. And in Santa Monica, and so I went there in January of '54. That's what it was. It would have been January of '54, and I went and got a job on the copy desk. Was really about three of us, I guess, and a news editor and a couple of copy editors. but that was a much more convenient place and to work, and so I you know, it was And I worked there for about 6 or 8 months, and then Harv and I had this idea of going to Europe. And we had friends who had just, a man named Leonard Slater, who was the Los Angeles bureau chief for Newsweek. Mm-hmm. He was a good friend of ours, and I used to do some freelance work for him. I would cover, sometimes when he had assignments from New York that he couldn't cover, he would ask me to do the legwork or go cover it and give him the notes or write up something on it. So I did a little of that on the side to making some more money, because the pay wasn't very much anyway on these papers. But he and his wife had just come back, had spent 8 months traveling through Europe in a little Renault, a little French Renault, and they sort of got the bug in us, and so we decided to we'd go to Europe for almost a year, and which we did during in 54. And Harva had a sabbatical coming, so she got off.
So she was still at UCLA.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now, did she? Let's back up a little bit. You say she was in journalism, and she'd been a journalist.
Right.
And where did she go do her college work?
Well, she was at Stanford. She was ahead of me, though, mm-hmm. and 2 years ahead of me, and because of the war, we didn't overlap at all. And then after she went to Columbia and got a master's at Columbia, mm-hmm. during the war, mm-hmm. and I think it was 44, 45, and then she worked briefly in New York for the WQXR, whatever the radio. She did the radio news stuff for this this station that was famous for classical music.
Oh.
Kind of a public station. It was, mm-hmm. kind of a pioneer public station. But then after that, she came back to Los Angeles and worked for the Los Angeles Daily News for several years, mm-hmm. which was kind of a liberal tabloid paper in Los Angeles, when Los Angeles had a number of different, mm-hmm. papers. So she got some pretty good experience. This was, most of the experience was during the war, and then she worked briefly for the San Francisco Chronicle before she made the
text. What was her maiden name?
Sprager, S-P-R-A-G-E-R.
Oh, okay. Was her family in journalism? How did she get interested in that?
That's what she wanted to major in college, and she really wanted to. I think she wanted to fly or something. Wanted to go into engineering, but her family wouldn't go for that. But they would go for journalism. But it's kind of fascinating in retrospect. Was that journalism was not. They did not encourage women in journalism. Mm-hmm. At Bush at Stanford, whom we both knew very well, and who came to be a good friend later on. Chilton Bush really actively discouraged women from majoring in journalism, but they still did, but the old rationale was that a lot of stories a woman couldn't cover a murder or a, mm-hmm. bad accident or, mm-hmm. So they really weren't. But the number of women kept increasing, of course, as time went on.
Did Harva go on to get a master's? She got a master's at Columbia.
Yeah, right, right, okay. Yeah, right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we ought to just stop for a few minutes here because of